Councilman Kalman Yeager has been a vocal defender of the Frum community at a time that we are under attack. The councilman has fearlessly called out anti-Semitic politicians whose rhetoric has led to a spike in anti-Semitism, specifically targeting the Frum community. Welcome to the Yeshiva World Podcast. My name is Yaakov M. Remember to check out my 24-hour news hotline at 848-261-NEWS, 848-261-6397. I spoke with Councilman Yeager, and it was an electrifying interview. He was extremely candid, full of passion. We discussed Ilhan Omar, the BDS movement, Mayor de Blasio, the new bail reform law, the city's response to the spike in anti-Semitism, and much more. The councilman also discussed getting thrown off a committee last year as a punishment after he tweeted that Palestine does not exist, plus many other relevant issues. Here is my exclusive interview with Councilman Kalman Yeager. Councilman Yeager represents the 44th District, which includes a huge chunk of Frum communities in Brooklyn. Councilman Yeager, thank you for joining us.
It's so great to be on with you. Thank you for having me.
It's really an honor for us. You recently made headlines by blasting local politicians who stoke anti-Semitism. You have called out soft anti-Semitism, where people mask their hatred of Jews, claiming they only hate the Frum lifestyle, the Frum culture, but they don't actually hate Jews. And my question is, how much of a factor do you believe, first, thank you for doing that. How much of a factor is soft anti-Semitism in the recent spike in hate crimes?
I think it has a lot to do with it. I'm not going to put a percentage on it, but I think what we've seen is, very frankly, a lot of people just simply saying whatever they feel like with impunity and then turning around and going, no, of course I wasn't anti-Semitic. I was just talking about yeshivas. Or no, I wasn't anti-Semitic. I was just talking about landlords. Or no, I wasn't I wasn't anti-Semitic. I was just talking about the weather in Washington. And I think that we have a serious problem as a community, you know, not you, not me, not any one particular organization, but all of us together, because what we've done is we've said, look, Mr. Very Important Elected Official, ma'am, you can feel free to come to our event. Please come to our dinner. Please come to our breakfast. Please come take a picture with us and let's do all these things. And we ignore all those vile things that are being said. And I think that that time has to end. The notion of the elected official who feels free to partner and pal with vicious anti-Semites, and then the next day show up at our event, they have to have the door slammed in their face.
Wow. And it sort of mimics what's been happening with Israel. Well, you have these national politicians, the BDS movement, you know, and these anti-Zionists and calling Israel a racist nation, but they're not anti-Semitic. And they've discovered this amazing way to totally mask their anti-Semitism.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, no smaller politician than Senator Chuck Schumer has actually said that BDS is an anti-Semitic movement. So you don't need a guy with a yarmulke to say it. There have been very strong voices in politics who have actually said very publicly, very loud, that BDS is an anti-Semitic movement. But I'll give you something better on BDS. It's not just those who are themselves BDSniks who are obviously anti-Semitic, and there's no question. Anybody who believes in BDS is a vicious anti-Semite. I don't care what they say, and I don't care what excuse they use. But then you have those who say, I don't oppose BDS, and I won't support a law opposing BDS because I personally don't support BDS, but I believe in free speech. And I've seen that in the city council. I've seen members of the city council who say, I'm not going to support something opposing BDS because that would impugn upon or infringe somebody's free speech. And I think that position is itself anti-Semitic.
Yeah,
if you're not willing to stand up and say that BDS is anti-Semitic and that those who propagate and promulgate the BDS movement and who lend it aid and comfort and aid and abet the BDS movement are anti-Semites, then you're an anti-Semite.
Excellent point. Now, getting back to the spike in anti-Semitism, after the Muncie stabbing, horrific attack, both Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo blamed the attack on President Trump, astonishingly, you know, on the rhetoric in Washington, which is so absurd to me on many levels. How do you respond to that notion that somehow Trump is responsible for the surge in anti-Semitism?
Well, they're not the only ones who did it. I think Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, as soon as that happened, put out something, you know, blaming white supremacists until it became clear who it actually was.
That's right.
You know, I think it's very stupid. This is not the opportunity or the place for me to parse through every single word that President Trump says and start defending him. It's not my job to do it, and it's not the place to do it. The reality is that the anti-Semitism that I've seen as a member of the New York City Council, as a resident of Brooklyn, New York, has not, in my very humble opinion, been perpetrated by those who adhere to the politics of Donald Trump. I think is the clearest way to say it. You know, when you look at what's going on in Brooklyn, New York, you tend not to see white supremacists perpetrating these hate attacks and these vicious, violent attacks. And setting aside Muncie for a second, because that and Jersey City, for example, those are two of the most extreme vicious and violent attacks where lives have been, in one case, lost, in one case, impacted in ways that will never be recovered. But when you're talking about Brooklyn, New York, and you're talking about a young, frum kid in a black hat walking down the street, and then a band of six teenagers decide, and we see this on video all the time, decide to attack him, to throw him to the ground, to knock his hat off, or a woman walking down the street in Williamsburg and two girls run up and start schlepping at her shaytl. Those are not being perpetrated by white supremacists. And the notion that they are getting their hint on what to do because Donald Trump has told them something is so ridiculous. And one of the reasons that it's ridiculous is because the politicians that I'm talking about are the loudest politicians who constantly hate on President Trump. One of them only refers to him as the Orange Man, never actually by his name or title.
Wow.
And there are politicians who are so comfortable saying vicious things about Jews and saying stupid things just in general. And they're the ones who are doing this.
You know, your candor and your direct talk is very, very refreshing. Mayor de Blasio has created a task force to deal with anti-Semitism. Do you know, are they really accomplishing anything? Is this just a political stunt?
Well, I'm not going to call it a political stunt. First of all, it's an office to combat hate. It's not an office to combat anti-Semitism. But I will say that was created through legislation that came out of the city council, and the intent behind it is good. And I want to say two things about that. First of all, I want to be very clear about the mayor himself. In my life, I don't think there's been a mayor who has had a closer, deeper personal relationship with the Orthodox community than Bill de Blasio. It doesn't mean everything he's doing is right. It doesn't mean that the response that the city's been doing has been perfect. But just on a very personal level, in other words, his relationships with the community, where he comes from, the fact that he was a member of the city council representing part of Borough Park, there hasn't been a mayor who actually knew us better than Bill de Blasio. And we've seen that on a lot of different things, whether it's Matitza Bepeh, whether it's certain aspect of dealing with yeshivas, and in fact on hate crime itself. I mean, I've had conversations with the mayor. I believe that he is deeply pained when he hears of an anti-Semitic attack. So put that aside first, just to understand the mayor himself and his personal comfort level with talking about this. The city's response is an entirely different thing, because you can chalk that up to, is the city ever competent in doing anything? So now let's talk about this office. There's an office that was created, and it's called the Office to Combat Hate Crime or something like that. And
but it's being run by somebody who used to work for the ADL. Is that correct?
It is correct. It is being run by a person who used to work for the ADL, and I have never met her in my life. I have never heard from her. I have never seen, maybe I've seen her at an event, so I don't want to say that I haven't, but I surely never had a conversation with her. She surely, to my knowledge, has never been down to Borough Park and walked along an avenue in my neighborhood. I don't know what it is that they do in that office.
I'm sensing some bitterness.
No, not at all. I mean, it's not like I have nothing to do all day, but I'm not going to call it a political stunt as much as I'm going to call it just another thing that's going on in New York City that nobody really cares about. Just another office that's going to suck up a couple of taxpayer dollars and probably not do anything. Now, but one of the things I said in my speech, and I think that this office is actually a symptom of, is there's constantly this conversation of, you know, education, tolerance. We have to teach. We have to, you know, get together in oneness, and all of these, you know, code words for, oh, if only everybody would just, you know, hug each other and dance nicely, it would be so beautiful. And I say to that, that's wonderful. That's a beautiful, beautiful utopian vision of what this city ought to be. I support it 100%. But first, security. government's job before anything else is to protect its people. What's going on right now is a symptom of a disorder that is related to law and order. It's related to crime and punishment or the lack thereof. It's related to a hefkeris or a chaotic state of governance in this city. So if you want to go into the public schools and teach people that maybe it would be nice if you didn't hate the Jews so much, that's great. Do that. That's wonderful. But first send me cops. First make sure that when something happens, we arrest the perpetrators, we prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law, we lock them up, and we throw away the key until those who are doing this learn that there are consequences for their actions. And, you know, part of what I've seen, and I think that this has proven itself, and great authority is the police commission, who said it himself, what we're seeing is a spike in crime because of the bail laws. I believe that together with a general lack of enforcement, together with the decriminalization of a lot of things that take place in New York City, where previously somebody would be afraid to, for example, decide to stop on the street and relieve themselves, and now no longer has to be afraid of that because you're not going to get arrested if you do it. You're just going to get a ticket and a hey, if you don't mind, would you mind not doing that around here? I think all of that has led to a state of chaos, a state of that there are no consequences for one's personal actions, a state of that if you do something, big deal. So they catch you. And so what? They send you back home the next day. They send you back home in 5 minutes. Who cares? And all of that together has created the perfect storm.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the bail reform law. I was just going to get to that because you mentioned de Blasio having this deep personal connection to the Jews. And as you said, that's all fine and good. However, he's been a proponent of these types of laws, which are really just a lack of law thereof. So we know the story of Tiffany Harris, then this man with multiple DWI arrests, released from prison without bail, kills a man. Bank robbers, as you said, they get released into court, goodbye out of court, back to the bank. Hey, I can rob another one because why not? And then Cuomo and de Blasio are saying, oh, well, gee, they're having second thoughts. So how culpable are Cuomo and de Blasio?
Well, I would separate New York City and New York City government from what's happening in Albany.
Okay.
And the bail laws, or the lack thereof, are a result of a literally a lunacy in Albany. Just lunatics running the asylum. It was the state senate, the state assembly, together with a pliable governor who got together and did this to us. The mayor has actually said several times recently that the bail laws weren't done wisely, and there, I believe he has said that there ought to have been a dangerousness aspect inserted into the law, that when cash bail was removed, there had to be something else for judges to hang their hats on. And just to explain that to your listeners, what that really means is in New York, what we've always done is when somebody came in to court having been charged with a crime, the judge would take a look at the rap sheet, the judge would take a look at the crime, the judge would take a look at what was done and how vicious it was and whether or not there's a likely that the defendant would reoffend while out waiting trial, and would use bail as a means of keeping that person in jail. The bottom line is that's wrong. It's not constitutional to do that. It was never proper to do it. But it was, in essence, it served as a proxy for what we call in law the dangerousness factor. There are states where a judge is allowed to look at a defendant and say, I think it's dangerous to put you back out on the street while this case is happening. I'm looking at the totality of the circumstances, your rap sheet, the likelihood that you'll reoffend, whether or not you have a permanent place to live and a responsible job, and you're an upstanding member of society. And so, no, I'm going to lock you up. It's called remand. Doesn't have to do with, I'm going to set a bail that's high enough that you can't meet it. But because New York didn't have that, New York was using bail as a proxy for that. And one of the reasons that was unfair is because if you have two people charged with the same crime and the judge looks at them and says, one judge says, I'm going to put $1,000 bail on you. And the other judge in another borough somewhere else says, I'm going to put $1,000 bail on you. And one guy has an aunt who can come up with a grand and the other guy doesn't. One guy sits in Rikers waiting for trial and the other guy doesn't. There's an inherent unfairness, and that shouldn't be the way it is in America. And that's the reason that this no bail movement came about. Putting that context over it, when Albany decided to get rid of cash bail to combat this problem, they either forgot or they're too stupid to have inserted the dangerousness aspect into the law of the state of New York. So therefore, now judges have no option. And that's where they messed up, and that's where they're going to cause somebody to get hurt really bad. And you actually pointed to a great case. I hate to say great, but there was a case on Long Island, exactly that, where the guy had been arrested a bunch of times, in fact, had been arrested just a few days prior to a drunken driving incident that killed people. He had been arrested because he was operating a vehicle without the required breathalyzer start, which the reason he had to have it was because of prior convictions. And if there would have been a dangerousness aspect where judges could have looked at it, the judge could have said, no, look, you just, whatever I do, you're going to go back out and you're going to do it again. I'm locking you up. And because the judge couldn't lock that guy up, the judge had to let that guy go. The guy went out a couple of days later, killed some people. It's just a matter of time before a guy knocks down an old lady in the middle of the street. He gets brought to a judge. The judge lets him back out. He goes back out. He goes into the subway, pushes a family of six onto the tracks. It's just going to happen. We're silly to pretend that it's not.
But we're begging for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
This past week, Attorney General Barr met with Frum leaders in Borough Park, including the Aguda. He announced that they are going to be charging suspects in anti-Semitic attacks with federal hate crime charges. I believe he said that Tiffany Harris is going to be charged by the feds. What are your thoughts on that policy? And also, were you surprised that no elected officials of the Frum community were invited to that meeting?
Well, let me take the second question first because it's easy. No, I wasn't surprised. It's not necessary that any of us have been there. He's the attorney general. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I'm simply a legislator, and my colleagues are the same. And what he was doing was announcing to the community what would happen, what was going to happen, and what his new policy was. But more importantly, he was going to hear from the community. And he was hearing from the community. We were fully represented in that room. Chaim Davids Weibel of the Aguda was there. The executive director of the JCC in Borough Park was there. Avi Greenstein, Ellie Cohen of the JCC in Crown Heights. We were well represented in that room, and I'm comfortable with that representation. The fact that I personally wasn't there doesn't besmirch the event in any way, and I'm not have no discomfort. It happens to be, by the way, that I have to be at City Hall that day. My two Albany colleagues, Simcha Eichenstein and Simcha Felder, were actually in Albany that day, and Chaim Deutsch had meetings downtown in Manhattan with dealing with education that I believe at with the chancellor, with the chancellor's office. So because we actually do talk, we caucus amongst ourselves, and we were talking, and it turns out that was the case. So not a big deal, and no harm, no foul. I don't think it was intentional. You know, it's fine. It's not like I don't speak with a lot of these folks that were in that room almost every single day. Look, I talked about this on Twitter yesterday, and in only 280 characters, you don't get to say a lot. Sometimes it gets me in trouble. But what I said is, take note, anti-Semites, the feds are here. And I said this back in December, I believe, when the feds indicted the Muncie attacker as well. There's a very important aspect that needs to be understood. The feds aren't just, lying around doing nothing all day. They have a lot of important work to do. And traditionally, public safety and policing has been the responsibility of the local government, the state, and therefore from the state flown to the localities, the city, the towns, the villages, etc. That's been the country, and that's the way the country was established. But historically, the federal government has stepped in when a state, when a local government has proven itself unable or unwilling to defend its people from violence. It happened in the 60s in the South. It happens all the time. And in fact, if we look back to Crown Heights, when it was very clear and when it became obvious that the state prosecutor, the local district attorney, couldn't obtain a conviction of Lemrick Nelson, the murderer of Yonkel Rosenbaum, the feds came in and said, we'll take care of it from here, and got the conviction. And so that's been a historical fact in America, that the federal government has stepped in and said, look, folks, you guys don't know what you're doing. We're going to come in because for whatever reason, you're not willing to protect your citizens. And it's not acceptable in this country. And today, we are the vulnerable minority population that is in need of that. So the Fed's coming in is a surprise. Yes, it's a welcome surprise. It's a sad surprise because it ought not be the case that they have to do it. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about a little bit, although it's not feds, but it's state related. My colleagues and I, right after the morning after the Muncie attack, we were really talking all night. I was talking to Simcha Eichenstein and Simcha Felder and I, and Chaim Deutsch and I, and we were all talking either amongst ourselves or all of us together. And we lost sleep over this, really, because this is a little bit of what we've all said is, you know, kind of, it's only a matter of time. I mean, we've been saying things like that. It's only a matter of time before something heinous happens.
Yeah.
That it's not just the kid getting knocked down and he gets back up and walks on and, you know, life goes on and now he's a little traumatized. But other than that, okay. And so we decided that we were going to ask the governor to step in. And we wrote a letter. And I wrote it all morning and I sent it out about 11 a.m. and I emailed it to the governor. And we asked that the governor do three things. One is send state troopers immediately to our neighborhoods to protect the population. He did that day. He announced like 2 hours after he got the letter, he made an announcement that he was doing it. Great. The second thing I asked for is that he call out the National Guard, and that they don't want to do. And the reason they don't want to do it is because that would basically be the governor himself being moida that he cannot protect us, that the city has failed, that it's come to the point where the National Guard has to be stationed in front of our houses of worships and yeshivas. And the third thing, and this is where the feds come in, we ask that the state appoint a special prosecutor for the purposes of prosecuting anti-Semitic crimes. So therefore, the state prosecutor would have the authority to take all the cases from all the different district attorneys, wherever it happens. If it happens in Manhattan, if it happens in Brooklyn, it's two different district attorneys. This special prosecutor would have the authority to grab those cases. In some way, what the feds have said is, we'll take care of that. If there's going to be an anti-Semitic attack, if they can link it to a violation of civil rights, which is not hard to make that case, because if somebody attacks somebody and of a particularized faith and gives some sort of indication that is the impetus, that's the reason why, in other words, knocks a Jew down and says, ha ha, Jew, you're down.
Right.
That's a violation of that young man's civil rights. That's a federal crime. And it's the same crime. Remember, Lemmerk Nelson wasn't charged with a federal crime of murder. There is no federal crime of murder. There is no federal crime of assault. There is no federal violent crime. What the federal crime is the crime of
violating civil rights.
Of violating someone's civil rights. That in and of itself is a federal crime. So I'm a very, very, very pleased that the Attorney General made that announcement. Very pleased.
Great. Changing gears a bit. Last year, you made headlines when you correctly said that Palestine does not exist. And I believe you were removed from the Immigration Committee of the City Council. And just sort of contrasting, Ilhan Omar, and obviously that's Congress, it's not local, she has minimized 9/11. She's minimized the Holocaust. She's compared Israel to Nazis. She sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is egregious. And are you surprised by that double standard?
Well, obviously we have different governing structures, the House and the Council.
Right.
I will say a number of things.
But there's never been an outcry.
There's never been an outcry. First of all, it's a year later, and I think I'm still right. If I check the math, nothing's happened since then. So I
really?
Don't think I wasn't wrong last year. I'm not wrong this year. The facts are the facts. You know, geographic reality is a geographic reality, and no amount of super wokeness by my friends in the City Council can change that. But It wasn't because somebody in the council said, you know, he's wrong. He's wrong. It's right there. I see it. That's not what they were saying. What they were saying is, that's just not nice. It makes people feel sad when you say that there isn't. So therefore, we have to do something, because otherwise the anti-Semites aren't going to be our friends anymore. When we come to the point where politicians are more concerned with having the friendship of anti-Semites than standing up for truth, for righteousness, and for the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, then that's where the problem is. In no way was first of all, and I want to be clear, I'm going to set, before I go to my next sentence, I just want to be very clear so people understand what happened. I was taken off the Committee on Immigration. The Committee on Immigration has never passed a bill that's become a law. It has zero authority over the budget of the city of New York. It is chaired by a colleague of mine who represents a piece of Borough Park, Carlos Menchaca. Those who want to Google him can. And I served on the committee because that was what they asked me to serve on. I served on five other committees, so no big deal. This wasn't about really, hey, you know, if he serves on that committee, the whole structure of New York City government is going to fall down. It was, we have to smack the Jew. How do we smack the Jew? Well, we can't take away his office. We can't fire him. We can't take away his staff. We can't take away the money that he gets to give out to the community. We can't restrict his ability to introduce and pass legislation. We can't do anything, but we can take him off a committee. Which committee should we take him off? The one that doesn't do anything. Okay, everybody's happy. They were hunting for a punishment. They found it. I'm fine with it. And life goes on. But really, that's what it was about.
Now, that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was. Honestly, I mean, look, the reality is those who follow New York City government, we have 41 or 42 committees in a city council of 51 members. and so if you do the math, you find that there's one member of the council who's the speaker who doesn't chair committees by rule, by regulation. It's just the way it works. And then there's a handful of us who don't chair committees because either he hates our guts or we just don't feel like it. And you have 41 members who are chairing 41 committees. And if you think that the city council has so much work to do, we need 41 committees. Look at the fact that every time the speaker decides so, he just shuts down the committee, merges its operations with another one, and we all go move on to have a latte. So it's meaningless. It's just, it was the point of the day. What I will say is, though, that the movement to get that done, the movement, the impetus in the city council was led by anti-Semites, was led by, in some way, in some places, people who actually represent from Jews. It was the cry on Twitter from the members of the council and from politicians was phenomenally coming from the super woke and the most left and those who pal around with anti-Semites in the most heinous ways. And one of the things that was most moving to me is that one of the first calls I got when this happened was from the one Muslim member of the city council who told me that, I know you have no hate in your heart. I know this has nothing to do with hatred. Don't worry about it. And he never tweeted or said anything negative in any way. It was the super wokes, the ultra liberal, let me show you that I am more of a minority than you are, even though I'm white politicians. And I think we all know who those are. And the reality is that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still there. So, you know, nothing really
happened.
You're
still there and Palestine still isn't. You were going to say something about Ilhan Omar. I cut you off.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I know I'm going to say something. It's going to sound, it may not sound right to a lot of people who listen to this, but it would be a fundamental violation of the fact that we are okay in this country with people saying wrong, stupid things, whether you agree with them, whether you don't agree with them. However, I think there's a fair question to ask whether or not she has the necessary expertise to have been on that committee in the first place, or whether the speaker herself was participating in the super wokeness of, oh, look at who she is. Look at where she comes from. Let's make sure she's on the Foreign Affairs Committee because she has so much experience in the foreign affairs of the United States. And I think that was the problem. And that problem didn't change. So no, she shouldn't be on that committee, but it shouldn't be because she's an idiot. It shouldn't be because she's an anti-Semite. It shouldn't be because she says stupid things, hateful things all the time. It should be because the totality of the circumstances of her resume, of her experience, of what she has to offer the United States Congress and the people of the United States of America is zero. Zero. And therefore, she should not be on that committee. Yeah. And of course, contrast that with my argument of, like I said, take me off the Immigration Committee. I don't care. But there aren't a lot of members of the city council who can say that their father came here on a boat. I can. So I don't really care if you don't want me to serve on that committee. It's fine. I'll find what to do with the 2 hours a month that I have to sit through that monstrosity. But think about what we're saying, that if we say the truth, if we do it not in the city council, not on the steps of City Hall, but somewhere on Twitter in the World Wide Web, the super wokers are going to come after you because it's time to smack at you. And that was part of what I have, when I talk about the anti-Semitism, the soft anti-Semitism that leads to the hardcore anti-Semitism, it's that. It's where the anti-Semites feel emboldened. They feel powerful by things that people who don't necessarily wear a white hood or a swastika on their arm, but are palling around with these anti-Semites. And they feel emboldened that it's okay to be an anti-Semite because, look, this guy's an anti-Semite. He's a councilman.
And finally, before I let you go, one thing I've got to ask you about. The New York Times ran a story yesterday entitled Seven Reasons Recycling is Not Working in New York City. And it says, as a New Yorker, you probably wonder, as you rinse bottles, stack junk mail, scrub yogurt containers, does it make a difference? And the answer is basically very little difference. 18% of trash from homes is actually recycled. And they issue fines when people mess up. It's a huge hassle for everybody, and it accomplishes so little. When are they going to let up on this sham, on this insanity?
Well, first of all, I'm gonna put this disclaimer out there. I frequently don't read the New York Times, so I didn't see the article.
Okay. But are you surprised?
Am I surprised? I am surprised that we're not doing as a city better on recycling than we ought to. And there are a lot of reasons why we ought to. First of all, fundamentally, I come at it from a financial place where I believe that when we recycle, we save money. In some cases, we make money. Historically, the city of New York has made money off recycling. When we stopped doing it, it was more because of bad management than anything else. But over the years, the city of New York has actually been able to market its recycles to the point where people were making money. The city was making money, and that was a good thing.
Right.
Because, you know, anytime we can have a revenue stream that doesn't come out of the taxpayers' pockets, I'm all in. So that's
right.
Good.
Right.
We also need to recycle just as a matter of environmental care for our own neighbor. We do have an obligation to do the best we can to keep the environment healthy. And if we're recycling and we are doing that, and even if it's a small thing that you're taking a piece of aluminum foil and you're putting it in the recycling instead of the garbage, that's great. But we're then turning over this material to the government. And if the government mixes it all together and throws it in the trash, I don't really know what the point of that is. Although I do know, as you said, I agree that surely the point is somebody's going to get $100 summons if they forget to do the right
exactly,
thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
But that's typical here in this city, because what the city does is their solution for everything. I actually had this debate on the Florida Council a couple of days ago. We passed a law that said that no store is allowed to refuse cash. Any stores, there are some stores popping up here and there that say credit card only, that they don't want to take cash. We passed a law that says you have to take cash. Now, I happen to feel that every store should take cash here in the United States. They should take and accept American currency. I also feel that if a store chooses not to, the marketplace will decide whether or not that decision is right and let the marketplace govern. And so we shouldn't regulate whether a store does it or not. Let the people decide. They walk into a store, they want to buy a $17 latte. The guy says cash only. They leave. Everybody's happy. Go across the street to the guy who's going to sell them a dollar cup of coffee, and everybody moves on. The, of course, super wokers in the city council decided to frame this as a place of discrimination, because the poor of New York City, the unbanked of New York City, and it's true that there are a lot of people who don't have bank accounts.
Right.
They either subside on a cash income, or they don't make enough that it makes sense to put their money in Citibank and get charged $25 a month. So they just don't have bank accounts. They don't have access to credit and debit cards. And that's true. I also think, as a matter of just not being a complete idiot, that they're not buying a $600 steak in a fancy restaurant. And they're also not buying a $17 latte at, you know, the super chai latte store in Manhattan. So, and I don't find this to be a problem where I go in Borough Park, where people are saying, no, we're only taking credit cards today, my friend. I'm sorry, you can't buy a slice of pizza here. Your money's no good here. So I just think it's one of those things that the city council does where they hunt for a problem. They have the solution, but they're hunting for the problem. It's a solution in search of a problem. My biggest problem, and that ties into the recycling question, is that the punishment for the store, when this takes effect in 9 months, is a $1,000 fine. Tell me how that makes sense. That makes sense that if we want to do a law and change behavior, that's great. The first violation ought to be a written warning. Hey, dear store, you may not know, but the idiots at the council recently changed the law. This is the new law. Please take care to make sure within the next 30 days you're doing the right thing. If not, some guy with a badge and a ticket book is going to come visit you in a month and write you a summons, and it's going to cost you some money. Thank you very much. Love, New York City. We do that, we will get the compliance
right.
without stealing money from the people of New York.
Oh,
that's
oh.
my philosophy on every law we pass, which is also why, and I'll leave this as a closing thought, that I have the highest number of no votes of any member of the city council, including the Republicans. I vote with Republicans frequently. I vote with Democrats frequently, but I have a higher number of no votes than any other member. A, because I read the bills, and B, because I resist stupidity.
And by the way, this is why you read the bills. Very innovative. This is why businesses are flocking out of New York City for reasons like you're saying. Councilman Yeager, I could literally speak to you all day. You've been a phenomenal guest. I'm so grateful that you're representing our community. Infinitely grateful. And I hope you will join us here again.
You invite me back, I'll be on.
Okay, awesome. Councilman Kalman Yeager here on Yeshiva World News.